Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. This is The Rundown, your weekly offering of news and views from Massey University's journalism students. Get your fix of what matters today from the industry's future players.
In the show today, we go to a remote island in Japan. We have the latest from the Middle East, and our reporter Josh McDougall joins us on the track.
Caused by Cyclone Vianu, have failed to dampen the spirits of those in attendance.
But first, here's George Hodgetts with the news.
The first direct peace talks between Lebanon and Israel have taken place in more than 30 years. Figures show that 2,089 Lebanese people have been killed and more than 1.1 million people displaced during Israel's most recent war with Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. Geopolitical analyst Jeffrey Miller says New Zealand needs to be more active with peacemaking in the Middle East.
It's a hard row, but I don't think that should be a reason not to try. And I think New Zealand can bring something to the table when it comes to peacemaking efforts in the Middle East.
It's reported Lebanon is trying to secure a ceasefire and address its humanitarian crisis. But Israel has refused a ceasefire and is demanding Hezbollah disarm. About 100 people showed up at Civic Square on Saturday with Palestinian flags and placards to oppose war and violence in Iran, Lebanon, and the Palestinian occupied territories. The organisers, Peace Action Wellington, earlier posted on Facebook that seeing Iranian flags could be triggering for some members of the community. But a couple of activists showed up with Iranian flags, upsetting Iranian activist Ada Tassavoli. Hamid Bahrani, who recently moved to New Zealand from Iran, says he was asked to take down his flag. He says he believes Iranians must stand by their governments to achieve peace. The sewage spill at Moore Point is causing ecological concern for scientists. Master's student Katie Fenton says she's noticed discoloration as far away as Porirua.
We might not be able to measure the impacts of this raw sewage outfall at the moment, but there certainly will be impacts whether we can see them or not through our ecological surveys.
The scientists plan to do research later this month. The rollout of electric buses in Palmerston North by Horizons Regional Council is becoming a talking point. Mark Reid from Horizons Council says the strong jump in bus patronage highlights how electrification is reshaping travel.
Horizons' electric bus rollout in Palmerston North is becoming a talking point, as James Meagher argues the continued need for diesel transport, despite rising petrol pressures, shows exactly why regions need cheaper, reliable transport options. Mark Reid, the manager for Horizon Council's transport services, says the strong jump in bus patronage highlights how electrification is reshaping both local and national travel, as New Zealand's energy future remains uncertain.
In terms of the additional patronage, we've had about 70% more trips on the network per year than what we had a couple of years ago, so maybe about 500,000 new trips on the network. So I say trips, it's, you know, someone catches a bus from Massey to the city, for instance. Using some pretty typical sort of factors, probably saved in terms of that side of things, maybe 300 to 400 sort of CO2 equivalent tons of emissions per year.
With multiple regions such as Timaru and their My Way by Metro electric buses shows the country's need for electrified services despite the current coalition's position on fossil fuels.
That was Riley Holloman with that report on electric buses. A classical music concert from Echoes of China performed at Fortuna Chapel last Sunday, part of the Colours of Fortuna 2026 concert series.
It's kind of very meaningful for me to play this to the foreigners, as they don't know about this instrument. And I just think that there are some kind of pathways, like performance, teaching, and kind of just collaborating with other musicians.
The musicians are all from China, current PhD students at Victoria University. That was just Winston Shu, the pipa player, saying that she's glad to bring this traditional Chinese music to show to Kiwis. There will also be an upcoming concert in Te Papa on the 8th and 9th of May.
Tensions remain high in the Middle East, but talks between Lebanon and Israel are being hailed as a historic opportunity by the US. For more than a month, Israel and Lebanese militant group Hezbollah have been at war. Thousands of Lebanese people have lost their lives, homes, and villages. Peace could be near, but fear remains daily. Lucy King takes a closer look.
Lebanon had expected peace, but then the guns grew loud again. It's unclear whether Lebanon is part of the two-week ceasefire announced last week. The US and Israel says it isn't, while Iran and Pakistan says it is. Hours after the truce was reached, Israel launched strikes on Lebanon and expanded its ground invasion in the south, where The Guardian reports entire villages have been destroyed. Lebanese House Speaker Nabi Berri says these attacks are a fully-fledged war crime. Otago University International Relations Professor Robert Patman says this disregard for international law is worrying.
I think one of the most worrying aspects is the complete disregard for international law by Israel, which is not respecting a number of key principles in international law, such as state sovereignty, such as the use of force only in self-defense, and also respect for the territorial integrity of another sovereign state.
Israel says it's targeting Hezbollah, a Lebanese political party and militant group that's backed by Iran. The group has been in an on-and-off regional war with Israel for decades. The latest round started on March 2nd, days after Israel and the US attacked Iran. In that time, 2,089 people have been killed and 6,762 wounded, according to Lebanon's health ministry. There have also been significant casualties among women and children. More than 1.2 million people have now been displaced. 350,000 of the now homeless are children. Auckland lawyer and senior member of Auckland's Lebanese community, Philip Curry, says that Israeli attacks on Lebanon are nothing new.
What Israel is doing to Lebanon now is a continuation of what Israel has been doing since at least 1948, when it ethnically cleansed the Palestinians from the land in Palestine and refugees came over the border, Lebanon, and sought refuge there. Israel seems to be a country which is incapable of settling disputes peaceably and prefers to use violence rather than attempt to reach a fair and just solution for the problems which it has caused.
Israel claims the airstrikes are targeting Hezbollah infrastructure, but the BBC and Al Jazeera report that heavily populated areas are being hit. Now, for the first time in decades, Lebanon and Israel are entering peace talks, but Hezbollah is excluded, The Guardian reports. Yet fear lingers of civil unrest between the Lebanese people and Hezbollah if Lebanon's government and Israel agree to work together. Professor Robert Patman says that one outcome is that Israel is threatening to trigger a new Lebanese civil war.
There's clearly quite strong differences of opinion between the Lebanese government, which is now about to have direct negotiations with the Israeli government, with the United States brokering, and the formidable pro-Iranian Hezbollah group, which believes that any negotiations in the current situation where Israel has the upper hand will generate outcomes which by definition will be unfair to Lebanon.
When asked what peace looks like for the people of Lebanon, Philip Curry stated the safest thing would be clearly divided and guaranteed borders.
It would be a two-state solution in Palestine where Israel and Palestine are two separate states within two clearly divided borders, and that the border between Lebanon and those states is settled and guaranteed by international law.
This was Lucy King for The Rundown.
Donald Trump's recent claims, paired with the growing tensions abroad, risk destabilising New Zealand's economy and fuel supply. Former Green Party MP Gareth Hughes helps us assist what this means. Gareth, thank you for coming.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Hi. On April 11th, President Donald Trump said in a social media post that massive numbers of empty oil tankers were heading to the United States to load up. And he says that they have more oil than the next two largest oil economies combined and that they're higher quality. How does rhetoric like this from figures such as Donald Trump influence consumers' petrol prices in New Zealand?
Well, I think it's already impacting consumers in New Zealand at the moment. I'm someone who is driving a lot less, and I know that's really common across the country. Unfortunately, we're also seeing fuel being stolen from school buses and farm tanks. So it's a real worry because it's such a critical part of our economic activity and just how we lead our modern lives. The US president seems to be acting entirely erratically, changing course, changing rationale for why he's doing things almost daily. In the absence of any international United Nations oversight or other countries being involved, it's a real worry for New Zealand, who is a small trading country who depends on the international rules to protect small states like us. And it's a real worry that large states like the US are so flagrantly breaching what was considered normal only years ago.
And what about our government? Do you think they're handling the situation effectively, dissuading panic? What methods or rhetoric are they or should they be using, in your opinion?
Well, no one wants to see the government panic, and they haven't done that yet. But I am concerned that they have been acting pretty relaxed. Obviously, we've got a four-step energy process and an advertising campaign at the moment. But if you just look across the ditch, you can see their government being a lot more proactive, actually purchasing fuel, making sure that arrives in Australia, providing more practical steps, such as many states are providing heavily subsidised public transport. I do fear that we know that the boats arriving with fuel really do drop off a cliff, according to official government data. Westpac's economist says the chances of rationing are incredibly high. I think at this point we should be doing all that we can to ensure that we're preserving the fuel, that we're actually giving Kiwis practical options to avoid this rising cost of fuel. For example, we could be supporting public transport more actively to get people out of their cars into buses and trains.
And do you think New Zealand will be able to stay neutral with war in the Middle East going on? Or are we inevitably going to be dragged into this because of greater power dynamics?
Well, there's always that risk that traditional security relationships with the US could come to the fore. I think at the moment that risk is lessened. We see our normal security partners from Europe to Australia refuse to participate in what I think really is a reckless, arbitrary, unilateral gamble, which really risks global prosperity, but also the US's international regard. So countries aren't getting actively involved with Trump's war, and I hope that we manage to stay out of it. New Zealand traditionally has taken a principled stance, which is to look to the United Nations as the appropriate international body to guide decisions like this. New Zealand should be acting independently, and New Zealand should be looking to the United Nations for any involvement. Obviously, what everyone wants, though, is a cessation of hostilities and to get back to a sense of international normalcy, and that's what New Zealand should be using its diplomatic heft to try and achieve.
Great. Thank you so much, Garrett, for being here today. That was very informative.
Nice one. Thanks very much.
People gathered in Wellington on Saturday to protest war and violence in Iran, which they are calling American imperialism. Madeleine Carwhite reports.
The whole system, shut it down! The whole system, shut it down! The whole system, shut it down!
About 100 people showed up at Civic Square with Palestinian flags and placards to oppose war and violence in Iran, the occupied Palestinian territories, and Lebanon.
I guess I've been concerned about what's happening in Palestine and Lebanon and Iran for some time. So, yeah, I just wanted to lend support.
The organisers, Peace Action Wellington, earlier posted on Facebook that seeing Iranian flags and pictures of the Ayatollah at the protest could be triggering for some members of the community. But a couple of activists showed up with Iranian flags, upsetting one Iranian woman. Ida Tavassoli, who's against Iran's government, held her own flag with the words, "Woman, Life, Freedom" on it. She says the appearance of the Iranian flag is triggering.
Yeah, you look pretty shaken.
Very shaken about that. Yeah.
But she acknowledges there are diverse views in the community.
This gathering was really to be against the regime and against the war in Iran.
And unfortunately, some people have brought some of the Iranian regime's flags that are quite traumatizing for a lot of us Iranians here. We've tried to respectfully ask them to bring that down.
The two protesters who were carrying the flags disagreed. Josie Campbell is in support of the Iranian government.
There's these people who believe that the regime in Iran are a violent... should I say that they're a violent regime? But the point is, it's not our, it's Iran's business. They don't come over here and tell us that we should be going against the national government.
Hamed Barani, who recently moved to New Zealand from Iran, says he was asked to take down his flag.
I said sorry. This is my country's flag. My government is supporting and defending my people and Palestinians people and freedom.
He says he believes Iranians must stand by their government to achieve peace.
We stand with Iran and with our government and our people, our army, and teach America and Israel a good lesson forever.
One of the speakers at the protest, Bahram Kagar, says he opposes the Iranian government, but he doesn't support the US either.
Today I'm standing here, you guys coming here, giving a heartwarming to us. The voice of Iranian, the voice of people who are suffering, not only from the America and Israel, from the internal regime as well.
Madeleine Carr-White for The Rundown.
Marine life surrounding Moore Point is likely to be affected following the sewage spill in early February. Tamir Schwartz talks to experts about what the biggest risks are to marine life.
The sewage spill has pumped extra nitrogen into Wellington's south coast. In a worst-case scenario, this could kill the kelp forests. But the most likely outcome is that it will provide a space for other species to take over. A lecturer of marine biology, Christopher Cornwall, is familiar with the area and studies kelp forest ecosystems.
There are an array of species that live on rocky shores, and some of them are really opportunistic when it comes to excess nitrogen. That includes what we call like green tide forming alga, so like ulva. Ulva was well renowned for living around Moore Point before that sewage upgrade back in the 90s. Most likely thing we're going to see is increases in ulva.
If these ulva take over the area, it can see a decrease in biodiversity and affect fish populations. He's among a group of scientists planning on getting out to Moore Point to do wading surveys. This lets them do research without putting their head underwater, the only option now because it's too unsafe. Research should start in late April.
These kelp are really important. They provide food and habitat for an amazing array of biodiversity. So most of the species that people are interested in eating are reliant on the kelp forest.
When the wastewater plant was first shut down in February, for 15 days the sewage was dumped through the shortfall pipe. As of nearly a month ago, it's going through the long full pipe. Chris says the longer pipe is not dumping directly onto the coastline.
And so having the long outfall in operation is definitely better, yeah. But it's not eliminating that problem, and it's not eliminating the problem for our diving.
Katie Fenton is a Master of Science student. She's noticed that even from some distance away in Porirua, there have been some changes to the coastline.
Or coverage of large brown macroalgae. The importance of large brown macroalgae, that's like kelp or the seaweed that you might see on TV, is that they are really important habitat-forming species, not only for our power and our kina, but for crayfish and lots of different types of fish.
Scientists have a good idea of what Moore Point looks like before the sewage spill because of 7 years of prior data. Katie says even if the damage isn't major, it'll still affect marine life.
We might not be able to measure the impacts of this raw sewage outfall at the moment, but there certainly will be impacts whether we can see them or not through our ecological surveys.
Tamira Swass for The Rundown.
On a unique and remote island in Japan, conservation efforts are being made to protect one of the world's rarest wild cats. Ruby Tiensma joins us live from Ere Omote Island. Hi Ruby, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. So what makes this cat so unique?
So what makes this cat so unique is its rarity. There's only 100 of them on Ere Omote Island, and they can only be found on Ere Omote Island, which is a island at the bottom of the Okinawa Islands. It's part of Japan, but it's technically quite close. It's technically closer to Taiwan.
Hmm. Cool. And what threats is this cat currently facing on the island?
So there are two main threats to the species. The first one is there isn't a lot of all of the cats are very similar because they're only on one island genetically. They're super similar, so they're not immune to any diseases that may come onto the island. So the biggest threat is tourism. So the tourism is increasing on the island. It's still super remote, but with the increase in tourism, there's an increase in cars. And that is the biggest threat to the Iriomote cat, is unfortunately they're getting hit by cars.
Cool. So what is being done to protect the species then?
So the main thing that is being done to protect the Iriomote cat is awareness. There's so much awareness on the island around the danger that cars are to the species. And you literally cannot drive more than 200 metres without seeing big signs saying, slow down, there are Iriomote cats. The speed limit on the whole island is only 30 kilometres an hour, which is quite slow on an open road, let me tell you. But it's to protect the cats.
Okay, awesome, Ruby. Thanks so much. That was very interesting.
The use of public electric buses in Palmerston North has increased by 70% in the last 2 years. As fuel prices continue to rise, the popularity of Palmy's electric buses has sharpened the political debate about how and when the country should decarbonise all public transport services. Riley Holloman reports.
Electric buses in Palmerston North have been on roads for a long time. It was the first city in New Zealand to switch the entire bus fleet from fossil to electric. It still is the only one. While other cities have larger bus fleets, none have all buses on renewable energy. Horizon Regional Council operates 42 electric buses in Palmerston North. Each has 300 km range on a single charge, and this is enough to cover a full day service. The fleet charges overnight at a new depot on Matapo Street. They avoid peak hours and use emissions-free electricity. Mark Creed, Horizon Regional Council's Transport Services Manager, says the move to electric buses has come at a time when high petrol prices are putting pressure on Kiwi commuters. He also says it puts a spotlight on political parties' plans for decarbonising New Zealand's public transport networks.
How do you think electric fleets will come into play with the current gas availability issues?
It's sort of the point of, if you've got it, you're in a good position, or if you've got orders on the books. If you don't, then new fleet, or certainly new electric fleet, coming into the network is probably going to be 9 or more months away. Yeah, if we go into more challenging times around petrol and diesel, to make sure the public transport network is available for them to be able to use.
Some are closely examining the performance of the country's first fully electric fleet. Greater Wellington Regional Council plans to follow in Palmy's footsteps by introducing more electric buses to its fleet next year. New Zealand aims to electrify all its bus fleets by 2035. This target was set in the Climate Change Response, or the Zero Carbon Amendment Act, in 2019. As a part of this target, the public transport authorities must only buy emission buses from July 2025. However, Associate Minister for Transport, James Meagher, defends the continued use of diesel buses. In a written statement to The Rundown, the minister says the government should be making the most of the diesel buses already in our fleet. He says it's important that the decarbonisation of public transport vehicles occurs in an economically efficient manner. The minister says zero-emission buses are the ideal, but we should not be pushing diesel buses hastily out unless it is cost-effective to do so, contradicting the popularity and initiative of Palmy's bus fleet.
One event affected by Cyclone Vaianu over the weekend was Taupo's annual Supercars, but gloomy skies didn't hamper the fireworks on track, as one young Wellingtonian put on a show for the Kiwi faithful. Our reporter Josh McDougall goes trackside to fill us in on all the action.
The roar of V8s filled the air. The Supercars, Australasia's premier racing series, has hit the track. Motorsport fans from all over the country flocked to Taupo for some world-class racing.
I'm from Kawerau. I'm from Wellington. I'm glad to be here. Obviously the weather isn't the greatest conditions tomorrow, but...
event organisers rallied to reshuffle the schedule to one day of racing due to the threat of Cyclone Vianu, but that didn't dampen the spirits.
I'm pretty grateful that the race has been moved forward, but yeah, just happy to be here, mate, happy to be here. Yeah.
Kiwi fans had an extra cause for celebration.
This 22-year-old Wellingtonian, Ryan Wood, has just won the feature race here this afternoon in Taupo.
Saturday's win in the 200-kilometre feature event followed a third-place finish in the shorter, earlier race, capping a career-best weekend for Wood. It was the second race win of his promising career. He spoke with commentator Jess Yates after the emotional victory.
Yeah, this is incredible. I can't believe it. Sorry about all my emotion. It just means so much to do it at home in front of so many friends and family and supporters of mine is so incredible.
It was a big day for manufacturer Toyota, recording its first ever race win in the series.
To win in our third round is, yeah, pretty special.
It was the third year of Taupo hosting supercars. The Taupo District Council's Head of Events and Promotions, Steve Giles, says the town has embraced the unique event.
3 years in, our community is starting to understand the event, that they're knowing where to work. Our retailers are preparing, very busy in hospitality, very busy in the accommodation sectors.
A unique event exhibiting Aotearoa's iconic glowworms is set to happen tonight in Auckland. Reporter Maya Trotman joins us from the Kai Patiki Eco Hub in Auckland. Kia ora, Maya, how are you?
Hi there.
Sweet. So what is happening tonight during the Magic of Glowworms event?
So there will be a guided tour speaking about what glowworms are, explaining their life cycle and how their bioluminescence works. And there will be a chance to take a photo in a forest filled with glowworms, which is popular with families with young children.
Awesome. How many people are expected to come to tonight's event?
So it's a book-only event tonight, and it's expected that nearly 30 people will come to walk through the forest and see some cool glowworm sites. They only have groups of 20 or less come through normally, so they're looking forward to tonight.
Awesome. And why is this event so important?
So glowworms are only common in the Waitoro Caves and in Matariki, but the Kaipatiki Eco Hub is one of the only ones in Auckland to give people the chance to see glowworms and learn about them.
Awesome. Could you tell us how glowworms are threatened in New Zealand?
Yep, so they're threatened by forest destruction and humidity, hot summers and flooding, but research and preservation facilities like Kaipatiki Eco Hub are important for keeping glowworms safe and thriving while showing them to the public.
Cool. That's awesome. Are you going tonight?
Unfortunately, no. It's booked out.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
Sweet. I know today in Wellington, there's a graduation event going on at the moment for Massey students, which is super awesome. So shout out to all those students today that are graduating. I hope you're having a awesome time. That has been the rundown. I've been your host, Anna Burnett.
And Stella Chung.
I hope you guys have a great rest of your day. Thanks
so
much.
Have a good day too.
That was The Rundown. Tune in at 1 o'clock every Wednesday for the freshest takes from Massey University's student journalists. That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.